Okay, so thanks, Alberto, for dropping me in it at the last minute to talk on third-generation gravitational wave detectors. So are we talking about on behalf of the U.S. Cosmic Explorer team? So one of the things I want to do is explain exactly what Cosmic Explorer is and what the plan is and how it fits in with the broader network of things that you may have heard talked about more, such as Einstein Telescope. So, oops, whoa. Okay, so we skipped all of second-generation detectors there. So going back, so second-generation gravitational wave astronomy, as you'll hear in talks by Ian and Ben coming up, is in full swing with the second-generation detectors, the first generation being the initial LIGO detectors that operated from 2000 to 2005, the second generation being Advanced LIGO and Advanced Virgo. And I grabbed this plot from the Gravitational Wave Open Science Center a couple of days ago. This shows an average day of the LIGO-Virgo-03 observing run and the sensitive distance in megaparsecs, 25, 50, 75, 100, up to 150 here, of the Livingston, Hanford, and Virgo detectors. So these things are operating very nicely, very nice ranges. The angle average range, so the distance at signal-to-noise ratio 8 to an averagely oriented source, is 130 megaparsecs in Livingston, 110 in Hanford, and 50 megaparsecs in Virgo. So things are going great here. Can I go forwards with this? Kagra, which is the Japanese gravitational wave observatory. Stefan Barmer, my Syracuse colleague, is over there right now. He sent me this status. It's an underground facility. It's a kilometer-scale gravitational wave detector underground near the Kamioka mine near Super K. They're actually the first detector on large-scale kilometer-scale to have cryogenics in a gravitational wave detector. The LIGO-Virgo detectors are room-temperature detectors using fused silica, so regular glass test masses. The Kagra detector is a cryogenic detector using sapphire test masses. So this is some of these are technologies that will be used in beyond second-generation detectors. So Kagra is kind of 2.1G that it's using some of these technologies that are not used in Advanced LIGO and Advanced Virgo. Their plan is to have full interferometer locking this summer, and they want to join LIGO-Virgo in the O3 observing run. So the O3 observing run is scheduled for roughly a year of observing with a break in between. And it started in April this year and will end April next year. So Kagra wants to be online and actually doing astrophysical observing by the end of the O3 observing run. They want to demonstrate that to the world and to their funding agencies. So they're making great progress. So the current and near-future network, LIGO Hanford, LIGO Livingston, Virgo, GEO is operating for technology prototyping. Its sensitivity is not really near the kilometer-scale detectors. Kagra is coming online now. LIGO India, the Indian 4-kilometer detector, has been site-selected, and progress is being made towards making that a reality. So that's the current and near-future network. What are these things doing? Well, just a brief review. So this is the Living Reviews article, the Commissioning Observing Scenarios document for Advanced LIGO and Virgo. We've had the early and mid observing runs. This is gravitational wave frequency along the x-axis here, so from 10 hertz to a few kilohertz. And the strain spectral density of the, sorry, this is the amplitude spectral density of the noise, where obviously lower noise at a given frequency is better because you have more sensitivity to the signals. These were the projections for the early runs, so O1, mid, O2. And these runs have detected 13 confident binary black hole mergers, so 10 from the LIGO-Virgo group and another 3 from the Institute for Advanced Study group of binary black hole mergers. And of course, one binary neutron star merger that we'll hear a lot about, GW7817, with a full array of observations across the electromagnetic spectrum. So this is great. O1 and O2, more than delivered what we're promised. The late observing is where we are now with the O3. And then a design, O4, we'll be talking about a detection every day. So modulo the fact that apparently binary black holes don't merge in June. The rate has been something like one a week in the O3 runs. And you'll hear more about that from Ben and Ian, who'll be talking on behalf of the LIGO and Virgo. Okay, so if we think about what we've done, so just one slide to illustrate kind of what the issue is. So 17817 is fantastic. And we'll hear more about this in the session that Cole and Jocelyn and Neil's been talking about. So we, 1708-17, we observed a multi-messenger signal. What this plot shows to show is we have, you know, great constraints on the tidal deformability of binary neutron stars. This was a primary goal. And we've ruled out the most, you know, the stiffest, biggest neutron stars with 1708-17 with the gravitational wave observations. But the numbers here, these low numbers here, are Bayes factors comparing a binary black hole waveform with a bunch of different equations of state. And it's only when you get to the stiffest equations of state you start to see small numbers ruling out these stiff equations of state. So all these soft equations of state, you can't really distinguish with 1708-17 with the gravitational waves alone between a binary black hole merger and a binary neutron star merger. So we've constrained the stiffest equations of state, but we haven't yet measured. If you got 1708-17 at design sensitivity, then you could start to distinguish, you know, these equations of state from binary black hole. But to do precision measurements, you know, 1708-17 at design sensitivity, we might be waiting a year. Another 1708-17 like signal at design sensitivity might be a year, might be 20 years. So if we really want to do this, we need to go beyond, you're guaranteed to do it, go beyond advanced LIGO to get precision measurements with these systems. So, oops, I'm going to use my laptop because this point, the projector is, laser pointer is running away with me. Sorry about that. Oops. So what can second generation detectors see? So the, you know, glass half full is gravitational wave merger events in the local universe, black hole mergers to redshift of about 2, neutron star mergers to redshift of about 0.1, glass half empty, most of the universe is still out of reach. So at design, the advanced LIGO network will see about 1,000 detections, binary black hole detections per year. But there's something like 100,000 binary black hole mergers per year in the universe. So we're only seeing, you know, 1% of the possible events that we can see, which is pretty impressive, from going from not being able to detect gravitational waves to seeing, you know, in a couple of years, 1,000 binary black hole mergers a year. But these events are, you know, relatively noisy. We're still talking about signal to noise ratios 10. And you can ballpark an upper limit on what advanced LIGO is going to see. So advanced LIGO is a factor of 10 more sensitive than initial LIGO. So the chance of advanced LIGO seeing anything more than SNR 80 is pretty slim, because that would have been an SNR 8 event in initial LIGO, and we would have already seen it in the few years of initial LIGO running. So unless we get really lucky, we're not going to get high SNR, high precision, high fidelity events with the second generation detectors. So what's the problem there? What limits the sensitivity of advanced LIGO? What limits the sensitivity of these detectors of moving beyond current sensitivity? The detectors themselves, for those who've seen a gravitational wave detector talk before, but let me review how these things work for people who might not be familiar. So what you do is you take a laser beam, you shine the laser beam through at a beam splitter, you bounce it off this mirror, recombine it, and detect it with a photodetector. And as a gravitational wave goes through this detector, it stretches one arm, it squeezes the other arm, you get a relative arm length change, which gives you a relative phase shift on the light that you measure with the photodetector. So LIGO is basically a timing measurement that says, how long does this photon take to go from here and back again versus here and back again? Compare that, read out the signal, and that reads out the gravitational wave strain. So in order to make this detector sensitive enough to detect strains of order 10 to the minus 21, 10 to the minus 22, you need to play a few tricks. So what you do is you put two mirrors, you basically set this up so you have an input test mask, an output test mask that makes a Fabry-Perot cavity. So you bounce the light backwards and forwards about 100 times in here and 100 times in here. That gives you an apparent arm length that's about 400 kilometers rather than 4 kilometers, the physical arm length of the detectors. So that makes the detector arms longer. This will be something important later. The longer the detector arm, up to a certain point, the more sensitive I have to gravitational waves. And it scales linearly with arm length. Then I have light coming back towards the laser, which is waste light. So I bounce that back in, make my laser beam look more powerful. That's both a blessing and a curse, because it gives you reduced shot noise. You have better sensitivity at high frequencies, but increased radiation pressure noise. So the laser light banging on the mirrors and making them move around, which limits your sensitivity at low frequencies. The other thing you can do is, I said, you know, what's the optimal arm length? Well, the optimal length for a recycled Fabry-Perot Michelson detector is store the light for half a wavelength, where you get the stretching. If you store it for a full wavelength, it might cancel out because you get the squeezing as well. So what you do is you take the light, the laser light that has sidebands, which contain the gravitational wave signal on it, you bounce them off a signal recycling mirror, they go back in with a phase flip, and so you get the first part of the cycle and the second part of the cycle add coherently, and that's signal recycling. You get more gravitational wave signal out at the end of the day. So what limits this in practice? Well, one of the big limits on sensitivity at the low frequency end is seismic noise. So this is the noise budget for advanced LIGO. The low frequencies here are limited by seismic noise, and then at lower frequencies, Newtonian noise. That's basically just masses moving around and dragging the mirror with them, just with Newtonian gravity. But seismic noise in advanced LIGO is bigger than the Newtonian noise. So the low frequency end is limited by seismic noise. The high frequency end, and also kind of here down at the low frequency end, is limited by quantum noise. So I alluded to this earlier. At the low frequency end here, this is radiation pressure. I turn up the laser, I get more photons hitting the mirrors, I have more radiation pressure on the mirrors, that's a noise source, and so that increases the noise at the low frequencies. At the high frequency end, I'm counting basically phase fronts coming back towards the detector, so the uncertainty principle limits the accuracy which I can know the time of that phase front arriving at the photodetector, and so photon shot noise limits my sensitivity at the high frequencies. To get rid of this, I want more power, so I want more delta E, so I get a better measurement of delta T. So I push up the power, but that then pushes up the radiation pressure noise here. So quantum noise limits me radiation pressure at low frequencies and then shot noise at high frequencies. Oops. And then the other source of noise, which is really pernicious, is coating thermal noise. This is the Brownian noise of the atoms on the mirror coatings jiggling around, and gives me a noise source in the middle frequency band right here. So this is the coating thermal noise. And there's a lot of work going on right now to come up with new mirror coatings. It's actually the coatings that are the problems, not the mirror themselves, to limit that noise source here. So what can I do to reduce quantum noise? So to reduce quantum noise, so shot noise and radiation pressure form the standard quantum limit. That was that green curve in the previous plot. Higher power in the arms decreases the shot noise but increases the radiation pressure. I can have larger mirrors. They'll react less to the impulse of the radiation pressure. Or in order to get rid of the shot noise and radiation pressure, I can squeeze the light. In fact, you squeeze the vacuum. We can describe the high frequency of shot noise like you get in a vacuum tube, but it's really a quantum effect. It's really vacuum fluctuations coupling in through the dark port of the detector that go in phase coherently and are seen in the differential mode and give you a noise in there. So what you can do is you can squeeze the light, or really squeeze the vacuum going into the dark port, and reduce the errors in one of the quadratures, either in the amplitude or phase. At the low end, you want to reduce the amplitude errors because that reduces radiation pressure. At the high end, you want to reduce the phase error. So when you squeeze the light, you actually want the squeezing to be different at different frequencies. So in fact, you want frequency-dependent squeezed vacuum, which sounds like voodoo. It's not. It actually exists. It works. It's running right now in Livingston. So this is frequency-dependent squeezed vacuum. This is about 3 dB of squeezing in LIGO Livingston and increases the binary neutron star range from 125 megaparsecs to about 140 megaparsecs. So squeezed vacuum is being injected into the LIGO detectors right now and is one of the key technologies for going beyond second generation detectors. So what about the near term? So A plus and advanced Virgo plus, so this is from information from Dave Reitze. So the plan is that on a 5-year timescale, there'll be modest improvements to advanced LIGO and advanced Virgo. Better mirror coatings, frequency-dependent squeezing, heavier test masses, suspension modifications, Newtonian noise subtraction. The ones with a star are plans for advanced Virgo. And this will give us about a 5x rate improvement, not sensitivity improvement, rate improvement for binary neutron stars. And Stefan said there are CAGR upgrades also on the horizon that are being discussed right now. The A-plus upgrades to advanced LIGO have been funded. This is the NSF award that funds the A-plus upgrades. So there's a $10 million of NSF money right now to basically design upgrades to the advanced LIGO detectors and take them to A-plus sensitivity. So that's kind of 2.5G. That's upgrades to the existing kilometer scale detectors. Okay, so getting to 3G. What does it take to get us from second generation to third generation? So this again is a plot showing the strain sensitivity of these detectors. Here's the measured O2 sensitivity. Here's the advanced LIGO design sensitivity. This is what the LIGO lab thinks I can get to with A+, with these intermediate upgrades to advanced LIGO. Third generation is going down here to what I've labeled these cosmic explorer designs. So what's involved in going from where we are now to there? So most of this upgrade rate, most of the improvement right here is just reducing noise, which is technology. It's better mirror coatings, better control systems, improving the way the detectors operate, beating down mystery noises. So this is really, you know, technology, R&D, to develop, primarily being the mirror coatings to get you down here, and improving the squeezing, improving the optical losses with the squeezing to get you down here. Going from here to here, you are now matching the antenna size to the signal size. So gravitational waves are many, you know, the size of a gravitational wavelength in the Earth baseband is tens of kilometers. So if you take your detector that is 4 kilometers long and you make it tens of kilometers long with recycling, so you get the 10 to 100 kilometer long wavelength that you expect for ground-based gravitational waves, you can make a substantial increase in the sensitivity right here. So Cosmic Explorer, so this curve right here, this used to be called LUNGO, for Long Uncomplicated Gravitational Wave Observatory. Take Advanced LIGO and make it long. So that's basically what it is. Take Advanced LIGO, use all the Advanced LIGO technologies, no cryogenics, no fancy stuff, and just have 40 kilometer long arms. Then there's a second phase here, which I'll talk about in a bit more detail, which is another, you know, noise reduction with improved technology. So actually changing the detector topology, changing the core optics, which can get you another factor of few going from Cosmic Explorer 1 to Cosmic Explorer 2. So this is kind of the path, the US path, Advanced LIGO, A+, and then a two-phase Cosmic Explorer to get from 2 to 2.5 to third generation gravitational wave detectors. One thing that people who may have been in the community who may have been making predictions for third generation detectors may notice is missing from this plot is the LIGO Voyager noise curve. So just a side note about Voyager. The Voyager concept is basically this is an upgrade in the 4 kilometer facility of Advanced LIGO to go from the current 1064 nanometer laser from A+ to going to silicon optics, so 200 kilogram silicon optics running at 1.5 to 2 microns with a 3 megawatt laser, and then running cryogenically in the existing 4 kilometer facility. So that was the Voyager concept. Right now, the status of Voyager is LIGO Lab has not yet converged on a post A+ timeline for the 4 kilometer facilities. And there are questions to be asked of should Voyager be installed as soon as the technology is ready, when the disruption of the global network will be minimal. There are several unknowns to the Voyager path. When will the technology be ready to go to silicon optics rather than fused silica optics? Which detectors will be online after 2025? What sensitivity? How many facilities should be Voyager class facilities? And then a big question is, you know, can Voyager be funded in a way that doesn't delay a third generation detector that gets you that big improvement to 3G sensitivity? And it's looking like the answer to this is this is probably going to be the biggest obstacle to Voyager, that, you know, the A+ is funded. The next big funding wedge will be an MREFC to get Cosmic Explorer funded. You know, do we want to dump money into Voyager that might push Cosmic Explorer further back into the future? So that's the side note about Voyager. So this can be summarized as predictions are hard, especially about the future. But moving even further into the future, where I can make even wilder predictions, there are two facilities that are currently slated to be running in the 2030, 2040 era for a true third generation gravitational wave detector. One of these is Einstein Telescope. This is a European design concept. This is a European led project. And then the other is Cosmic Explorer, which is the US led effort to develop a third generation gravitational wave detector. And I should emphasize that these two are not competing with each other. These two are complementary to each other. And so, not just in terms of, you know, what the detectors themselves can do, but in terms of the technologies that are being developed to make Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope a reality. So what do these two detectors look like in terms of event rate and sensitivity? So turning one of these sensitivity plots here, this is Advanced LIGO at design. This is ET, the Einstein Telescope sensitivity. This is the Cosmic Explorer sensitivity. So this is C2. So turning this into a horizon distance for binary mergers. So this is the total mass in the source frame of the two components of the binary. So binary neutron stars are down here, and then binary black holes are all the way up here. And so the horizon is the furthest you can see, and then 10% of detected sources, 50% of detected sources, depending on the orientation of the source. So, you know, we're talking, you know, Z of 0.1, as I said, for advanced LIGO. This goes way up to Zs of a few for binary neutron stars. And then out here, we're seeing, you know, for 30 solar mass binary black holes, you're seeing out to Zs of 100 out here. So this is incredible. This is, you know, if you think about where we're going from, you know, a few years ago, we hadn't detected gravitational waves. Advanced LIGO is Galileo's telescope, first observations. We're kind of a generation and a reasonable technology roadmap away from a detector that will see every binary black hole merger in the universe. So going from, you know, just being able to see gravitational waves to, oh, we can see every binary black hole merger in the universe in one step is pretty good going. That's thanks 1 over r, not 1 over r squared. So you know, what we'll get from these detectors is, you know, binary mergers throughout cosmic time. This is the nice little plot that that Evan Hall and Salvo Vitale made that basically shows on this side is the binary black hole, the horizon for O2, so we're seeing, you know, a few of these things here. A plus would get you a good chunk, and then binary black hole for Cosmic Explorer 1 and Cosmic Explorer 2 is getting you every binary black hole merger in the universe. CE1 is seeing a huge number of the neutron stars. CE2 is kind of pushing out to very high redshifts for the horizon, not the average. This is the horizon. Getting out there, seeing many, many, many of these binary neutron stars. So precision measurements of the close ones and seeing the whole population for the distant ones. So what else can we get? One slide that people are looking at now is early warning for binary neutron star mergers. With advanced LIGO at design, it might be possible to get a few minutes of warning before the merger, not really enough to get much sky localization out in advance. But with the next generation detectors, you can build up enough signal to noise to get hours of warning before a binary merger happens. So you can basically have a heads up that a binary merger is going to happen in the future, which would be great for observing strategies. To take this to actually an observing strategy requires work, and that's what we're doing right now. So what can these third generation detectors see? Well, I said every binary black hole merger in the universe, direct detections of binary black holes at high redshift, precision exploration of cold dense matter in neutron stars. We'll have enough sensitivity at the high frequency to see the post-merger signatures, which are really inaccessible for second generation detectors. We'll get high fidelity detections of the nearby sources, and we'll just see enough sources, many more sampling of the population, that we have a higher chance of seeing these oddball sources, the most massive, the least massive, the spinniest, the precessioniest, to sample the space and get the and find those ones that tell us a lot about the physics. We'll get precision tests of general relativity and possible exploration of new physics. Let me just say something about supernova. I talked about binary mergers. There's a few people here who care about supernovas. So we tried an experiment. Varun led this as a grad student in Syracuse with Chaitanya to try and see if we could optimize a Cosmic Explorer class detector for supernova detections. And even we said, you know, give up on binaries. You know, do the best you can for suppose binaries are boring by 2035. And you really care about supernova, you know, we'll even let you give up on the binaries to do this. And it turns out there's not really a lot of wiggle room to do it. Varun managed to come up with a optimization that gets you a bit more sensitivity here. This is a log plot, so it doesn't really do this justice. It compresses these frequencies here. If you put this on a linear scale, you actually see you get a good chunk of extra sensitivity here for the supernova compared to the low frequencies. But unfortunately, you're only increasing from 70 kiloparsecs to 95 kiloparsecs at signal noise ratio 8. So you're still talking about sources in our galaxy and the Large Magellanic Cloud, Small Magellanic Cloud. You're not getting even out to Andromeda yet. So this is comparable to June, though. You know, we'll get for something at 10 kiloparsecs, I think June gets 3,000 neutrinos. We'll get really loud SNR and Cosmic Explorer. For something in the LMC, June maybe gets, you know, order of 100 neutrinos, and we'll get a nice nice loud SNR in Cosmic Explorer. And then Andromeda, it's one neutrino for June, and it's digging in the noise for Cosmic Explorer. We actually did a study and said, you know, what could you do if you just said, okay, pretend now we can upgrade 3G, and you can push it out to a megaparsec which is one in 20 years, but you're still not getting out to far enough distances to really up the game with the supernova detection. So we're still going to keep our fingers crossed. Okay, so what's going on? So Einstein Telescope, say a bit more about the technology. Einstein Telescope, there's a conceptual design in 2011, which has 10 times the range of the advanced detectors at a cost of €1 billion. It's an underground facility with 10-kilometer long tunnels, big underground 25-meter high vertex rooms with a 20-plus lifetime for the facility. It has three nested detectors in a triangle configuration with equal sensitivity for both the gravitational wave polarizations. And these nested detectors are, in fact, there's a high-frequency detector here that gets to the high frequencies and a low-frequency detector. So this is a xylophone configuration. With fused silica at room temperature for the high frequencies, and then cryogenic silicon at low frequencies to get you the combined noise curve of both of these detectors. Cosmic Explorer, on the other hand, is a L-shaped facility. Like I say, it came from a concept to just scale up LIGO. 40-kilometer L-shaped detector, probably on the Earth's surface. Maybe we're exploring underground. One interferometer in each facility. 14-centimeter wide laser beams, 2-megawatt laser, and what's going right now is R&D to kind of get us from there to the year 2030 in a cost of $1 billion. As I said, Cosmic Explorer is a two-stage approach. CE1 is looks a lot like LIGO, so 1-micron lasers, fused silica. CE2 then goes to cryogenic silicon detectors and gets you the additional boost. And I should emphasize that, you know, CE and ET are complementary. They're supposed to be part of a worldwide network. You know, one ET and Ku Cosmic Explorers would be awesome, but comes with a fairly hefty price tag. So what we want to do is explore the benefits of the various network configurations, which is what we're doing right now. There are other possible detectors. So the Australian Osgraph collaboration is exploring a high-frequency detector, which is in conceptual design. Ignoring low frequency simplifies things a lot, but you can still get a lot of physics from the high frequencies. And of course, with LISA operating on this time scale, you can get multiband detections. There's a recent paper from Kirk Cutler and collaborators where you see massive black hole mergers in LISA and then in Cosmic Explorer Einstein Telescope, and you get M-CHIRP from LISA, M-TOTAL from the ground-based detectors, and you get precision measurement of these intermediate mass black holes if they exist. Few words about the facility challenges. 40-kilometer long arms are expensive and tricky. It requires earth-moving, tunneling, 40-kilometer-long vacuum tubes, finding a site. Possible sites do exist. This is the Bonneville Salt Flats in Utah. One of the things the Cosmic Explorer team is doing right now is exploring, this is work by Evan Hall, to explore possible places in the U.S. where you could reasonably put a 40-kilometer detector. Words of caution, low frequency is hard. LIGO is not yet at its low frequency sensitivity. There's mystery noise down here that limits its sensitivity. These are ambitious goals of 10 hertz, 5 hertz, and 3 hertz for all of the detectors. And so getting down to low frequencies is challenging. Reducing mirror motion is going to be an active area of research for third generation detectors. There are two solutions. There's the passive solution that Virgo uses, these super attenuators. The active solution, basically noise canceling headphones that LIGO uses. This is going to be a challenge, technology challenge moving forwards. High power and lots of squeezing. You know, the highest power we've demonstrated in the arms of an interferometer so far is 250 kilowatts in advanced LIGO. 3G requires 3 megawatts of power in the detector. So this is a 10 times power increase. Best squeezing demonstrated in a tabletop is 6 dB in GEO, 3 dB in Livingston. We need 10 dB of squeezing, so we need 3 times the reduction of the optical losses when we put that squeeze vacuum into the detector. Extremely challenging is you know, we've had a lot of experience of 1064 nanometer lasers and optics and photodetectors going to silicon. Silicon is opaque at 1064 nanometers, and so we need to develop completely new lasers, photodetectors, high-efficiency photodetectors, if we want to move to cryogenic silicon optics. But again, this is doable. This is not beyond the realms of possibility. So where are we now? Briefly, The GWIC white papers are out, so if you want to look at the science case, you can see all these on the archive. These are submitted for the ASTRO 2020 that detail the decadal survey. And let me just skip ahead. I'll show you the, I can come back to this if people are interested in terms of the funding profile, but these are the two key roadmap diagrams for Cosmic Explorer, the 40-kilometer detector. So we're talking about, you know, stage one R&D starting basically now. So we are funded right now. There is US funding for Cosmic Explorer. So the Cosmic Explorer team is Syracuse, MIT, Caltech, Fullerton, Penn State. We're doing what the NSF calls the horizontal design study that's going to lead to a white paper in 2 years that the community will endorse for the US roadmap. Then that will go into stage one research and design, and then construction and commissioning. So we're talking about observations, operations of CE1, 2036, CE2, kind of 2044 timescale. And then ET right here. So this is the ET roadmap. They have a very solid roadmap. This is a slide from Michaela Puntura at the recent Dawn meeting. And they're talking about operation, you know, early 2030s right here. Sounds like a long time, but really it's not. There's a lot of work to do between now and then. So one of the things we also need to do, particularly on the US side, is you know, investing in a 3G detector is a big undertaking for the science community. We need input beyond the existing gravitational wave community, so we need broad buy-in from everybody who's going to be using these facilities. And in the US Cosmic Explorer team, we're currently deciding how to get input from the wider community. We'd like to get something set up soon, maybe like a LISA science consortium type of thing. And I'll stop there by saying current detectors see the local universe, and detectors that can see the entire universe are within reach. And funding is starting flowing for third generation detectors, both in the US and Europe. And planning is actively underway. And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Okay, plenty of time for questions. Someone's got to start. All right, Monty.
Okay. I'm listening to you, Monty. I need liquids before I can answer you, though.
Okay, so the question I have for you was, you briefly mentioned some Australian effort for high frequency. How real is that, and can you tell us more?
Oh, I have a microphone already. So Den Martinov has a paper out that is looking at this OSGRAV high frequency detector. They are currently in a conceptual design study. So it's real in the sense that OSGRAV is funded to do a conceptual design study. So it's as real as anything else. It's kind of an exciting thing as well, because this is one of the things we need to really scope out moving forwards, which is, you know, we now have this awesome kind of palette of stuff on the table of ET, Cosmic Explorer, OSGRAV, maybe something that will be happening in the 4K facilities. And so a lot of the research we want to do on the science case side for the CE white paper that NSF has asked us to do is, okay, so suppose you don't get ET plus two Cosmic Explorers, right? What's the science case for each of these blended configurations? You know, with one Cosmic Explorer, you get neutral star physics, right? You get the cold dense matter stuff. You maybe don't get sky localization as well, but maybe you have GRB CubeSats flying then and you can get the localization from them. So, or maybe you get, you know, high frequency detectors like the OSGRAV thing, which will get you the localization, but not get you the low frequency precision stuff. So OSGRAV is conceptual design study stage. They're working on it. They have a plan. It's realistic. But it's not, you know, none of these things are funded at the level of...
What sort of sensitivity are they
trying to It kind of looks, it's a little bit worse than ET high frequency. They basically give up on the low frequencies and then just push down, not quite as good as kind of Cosmic Explorer 2, but better than A+ at the high frequencies.
So along those lines, what does the localization look like for Cosmic Explorer? Specifically, you talked about early warnings. Do you get pretty decent localization early enough to use it? What does single detector localization look like? You must get something from the time changing antenna.
This is precisely the stuff we're working on right now. The we've looked at like the SNRs for early warning. Evan and Matt have a paper where they're looking at localizations. I mean, if you have the, you know, people have done the ET plus two Cosmic Explorer, and you can get, you know, good localizations many minutes before merger. But downscoping that is challenging. The other thing is, you know, do you really want to, you know, the limit you have observing facility limits, right? I mean, if you can't get a, you know, source with 8 hours of integration on DCAM, do you really care about localization for those binary neutron star sources, right? So there's also a question of, you know, where do I draw the line between I really care about the three detector network for these sources versus one detector is good enough for the far away stuff to get the science that I'm going after. So this is the type of stuff that, you know, the GWIC science case kind of lays out you know, plan for what you could do with some back of the envelope estimates, and now we need to turn that into a real science case that will actually get $1 billion detector funded. So that's what's going on right now. So this is exactly the type of question that we need to answer.
So I'll ask the question I asked you yesterday, which is SNR 15 with Cosmic Explorer is SNR 1.5 with the existing LIGO A plus and systems. And if you have 5 of those, that's signal to noise of 3, so that gives you localization. So why shut them down and why not include them, especially if you're interested in the localizing, especially the nearer, brighter sources? It seems that you don't actually need to cosmically.
Yes. I mean, you can, so one of there's two questions. There's shutting them down is a funding question, but there's also a facility lifetime question, right? That we know the beam tubes in the LIGO facilities are decaying. And so, you know, the LIGO facilities were designed with a facility life. And so if you can keep those detectors going, or you can upgrade them, you know, you put the Osgrav design in the existing LIGO facilities and LIGO India, exactly, right? So I would argue that, you know, a good third generation network is gonna be a blend of, you know, 2.5D detectors that we keep operating, one, you know, a Cosmic Explorer, you know, hopefully ET, but it doesn't have to be 2 Cosmic Explorers in the US to get great science out. You can do that with keeping one or more of the second generation facilities running, which might be India, which isn't built yet, and so its facility life is gonna stretch into the 3G era. So this is precisely what we need to look at. I think the funding roadmap there is, you know, what's funded is A-LIGO, A+, and then, like I said, with Voyager, the question is, you know, there's no decision within LIGO Labs to what happens to those facilities afterwards. So my personal feeling is the high-frequency detectors get you the localization, so you possibly don't need many low-frequency detectors to do the exciting science. And they'll see it's the loudest sources you care about for the localization anyway, and the second generation facilities will get a good chunk of those. So we need to explore the contribution of the second generation network to 3G.
Right. Just to extend that, so assuming we have the second generation, why do we need both Cosmic Explorer and ET?
You want to get pulled. So one of the big issues for getting the masses of the black holes at large distances, if you can't break the inclination distance degeneracy, which you can break with polarization, then if you don't know the distance, you don't know if you have an uncertainty about the distance and the inclination, that really translates to an uncertainty on the mass, because that distance translates to redshift, and backing that out to get the source frame masses, even if you knew H0, you know, in the 2030 era, that puts uncertainty on the source frame masses. If you care about the source frame masses of the most distant black holes, you want multiple detectors to get the polarization, to break that distance inclination angle degeneracy, and that then breaks the redshift degeneracy that gets you the source frame masses.
There had been talk about a triangular ET.
ET is a triangle.
So
ET gets you the polarization, but Cosmic Explorer will get at you better as well. And one of the future is, you know, one of the questions for the future is there a US effort, a European effort? How do these come together? You know, talking to Dave a couple of weeks ago, you know, this is being discussed at the intergovernmental level, which is above my paycheck to comment on that. So the plan is there'll be an ET design, a CE design, and then, yep.
Just to build on that some more, what is the sensitivity to multiple polarizations from a single Cosmic Explorer? I mean, the time changing antenna pattern, that must give you some probe at multiple polarizations if it's in the band long enough, right?
Yeah, but for binary black holes, it's not that long, right? For binary neutron stars, it's in for many minutes, but these massive black holes, you know, finding these, you know, the very high redshift massive black holes, they look like LIGO signals, right? So that you don't get that much because they're that short.
With respect to the localization, if you're actually going to have some of the double neutron stars in band for several hours, and the Earth is going to rotate a decent amount in that time,
yeah, then you get
how much does that actually help you? Because this is largely going to be at the low amplitude, low frequency portion of the signal.
I don't think anyone's calculated that carefully yet. I don't think anyone's done the modulation of the signal for the localization for the binary neutron stars carefully yet. Mm-hmm.
So in respect to numbers of black holes, going from 1,000 a year to, you said 10 to 500,000 a year, and making the point about oddballs, don't you think you're going to see oddballs already in thousands of them?
So it's
not a, probably a good point to make to those funding agencies.
For the binary neutron stars, it is, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Does anyone have $1 billion they want to? Yeah. Actually, one of the things is talking about DOE funding as well, that we need to get the DOE interested in this. So DOE can help out NSF. For the master case, yeah.
Essentially, it's essential, right?
Yeah.
At this scale.
So going back a little bit to the coordinating follow-ups and stuff like that. So how much study there is ongoing about that? Because most of these sources, like the neutron star binaries, are going to be a redshift one. Or farther, you're talking about advanced sky localization, but that's probably going to be like at most a few hours in advance, at best like tens of square degrees, I assume. So how, there is an idea how to tackle this, because you know you first have to narrow down the field of view and then really point something powerful, but necessarily narrow field of view to get a possible counterpart redshift larger than one.
Yeah,
so I don't know how much study is going on.
There is some study going on, but the question is not answered yet. And even, I mean, the EM side of things, could you, you know, if you're going beyond 500 megaparsecs, is it, you know, going to a gigaparsec, is it feasible to find a kilonova with any facilities that exist on the 2030 timescale? Yeah,
so in the multi-messenger white paper that went out as a 3G study, I mean, the bottom line of that is that, I mean, the 3G detectors are way beyond our wildest dreams from the EM perspective. So we have a table in that white paper, which is basically, if you take the 30-meter class telescopes, you take LSST, you take whatever the biggest, wildest dreams on the EM side is for from gamma rays through radio, what sensitivity would we have to compact binary mergers? And it pretty much stops at Voyager. I mean, ET and Cosmic Explorer are just, I mean, have horizons that are just way beyond the wildest EM dreams, at least in the 2030s. So, yeah. But some subset of them would be.
I mean, we still have the gamma reverse, so some subset will, you know.
We'll have GLBs.
In some sense, that's nice because it's kind of, you know, we can turn gamma reverse into redshifts. It's a proven science. So there'll be some small fraction. But, you know, still be, that small fraction will be very interesting.
When you have a tiny fraction of this many signals, that's still
a non-trivial number, yeah. Actually, let me, given that we have 2 moments, let me just show 2 slides, which I stole from Pedro Marionetti, who's the NSF program officer for the gravity division. So these are probably important to show. So Pedro showed these at the DORM meeting in 2019. This is the NSF's major research equipment facilities construction process. Where we are right now is horizontal design, which will lead into conceptual planning, which leads to preliminary design, which leads to final design, which leads to construction operations. And this is taken verbatim from Pedro's talk, where he's basically laying out a timeline that leads to the appropriation of MREFC funding for Cosmic Explorer in 12 to 15 years. So, you know, so when your NSF program officer comes up to you at a meeting and says, this is the roadmap, you better get yourself moving, because this is not that long, that's a good thing. And where we are right now is we're funded to do this horizontal planning leading to the Cosmic Explorer white paper. We're 1 year into the 3 years here, and then that leads to community endorsement, and then all these subsequent steps that lead to appropriation of the construction funds for Cosmic Explorer. So this is actually really exciting, because this is NSF is treating like, you know, they are planning for this. It's not vaporware.
But be clear, the total amount of funding is exceeding, right? I mean, so NSF alone through this program, I mean, that's enough to fund Cosmic Explorer?
Well, MREFC is a congressional appropriation, right? So they can ask for whatever they want. It could probably help to have DOE contribute as well, and so.
Okay, if not, let's thank Duncan.